You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, September 10th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder, the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, William Arkin, author of Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect War. Also on the program today, the House Republicans have a plan, perhaps, to not vote on the Iran agreement. They have a meeting today at 4 p.m. to figure it all out. John Boehner, the final days of John Boehner, ladies and gentlemen. On the heels of the announcement this week, the heels? The toes. The heels. Of the announcement this week on Labor Day of paid sick leave for federal contractors, Andrew Cuomo the Lesser, I'm sorry, even still, credit where credit's due, is announcing a proposal for a $15 an hour minimum wage in New York State, supposedly to be joined by Joe Biden at the press conference. Also on the program today, Donald Trump. Man, the guy's rising in the polls. So isn't Ben Carson. You know who's not? Jeb Bush. Scott Walker. If Jeb Bush was at 32 points, I don't know that we would talk about it, because that is a real dog bites man story. But you know what I want to see, too, is someone write the data breakdown on how all the data journalists were wrong about Donald Trump. That would be fascinating. And a day late, dollar short, the Department of Justice issues guidelines saying that we really should maybe arrest white-collar criminals. Just guidelines. Huh? You know, last night, it just occurred to me.
I kind of want to do the Romney voice for that. Just like, you know, fellas, I'm thinking maybe we should ought to do our jobs when it comes to Wall Street.
There's also a new affordable. Well, let me put it this way. There's some activity on a new Affordable Care Act case called House v. Burwell. And I'm seriously debating as to whether or not we're going to dedicate a lot of time to it. I think we definitely, we very well may have a guest on to talk about it. But this is a case brought by the Republicans in the House, charging that the president's, there's a couple of issues, and, you know, we'll talk about it later, but it's just interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it's one of those cases that could really seriously damage the Affordable Care Act. Two, it's one of those cases nobody thought would ever go forward because of case law in the past. Congress has rarely, if ever, been found to have standing in this type of case. But we will talk about that later in the program. And an ex-tennis star, James Blake, tackled by cops in New York City. And just totally coincidentally, he's black. And also, lastly, there is a potentially a new species of ancient human discovered in South Africa, which
I prefer species that have survived.
Right. Donald Trump immediately came out and said they were losers because they obviously didn't. They didn't survive. I prefer my human species to make it. That's all right. That's just me. All right. It is also September 10th. I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to William Arkin is because one of the fundamental changes that has taken place, and this is a guy who is a real expert on intelligence, U.S. military intelligence, and national security intelligence. One of the fundamental changes that has taken place over the past 15 or 14 years, I guess, since 9/11, has been in this realm of what the national security state, the size of the national security state, the amount of data that it collects, the attitude towards that data. Data. And, you know, it's just one of the things that I think, you know, as we look back on that time, as you know, one of the artifacts that remains with us to this day that has actually sort of metastasized, it seems to me. And, you know, in his book, he makes it clear this didn't start with 9/11, but we will talk about that. Also, tonight is the first game of the NFL season. Pats, Steelers, and Tom Brady, who apparently likes the man who should not be named, will be playing, as far as I know. It is opening week of the NFL regular season, folks, and it's the last chance you have to join FanDuel before this opening weekend. FanDuel is the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They're paying out over $75 million a week this football season. Building a team is easy. Just pick your players, stay under the salary cap, sit back on Sunday, watch your team win. Entry fees start at just $1, and anyone can play. Go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use my code MAJOR and sign up now. It's MAJOR, as in Majority Report. Major. Majority, same. Special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. Offers only good for the first 50 people that use my code MAJOR today. Don't forget to use the code MAJOR. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Sign up today. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with William Arkin.
I'm on a set my soul on fire.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program William Arkin. He is the author of Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect War. He is currently a national security advisor to Vice News, has a been a former reporter for the New York Times, L.A. Times, Washington Post, and author of American Coup. Welcome to the program, William.
Thanks for having me on today, Sam.
So, you know, I think, you know, you would argue in your book that this that we were on this path, if not already sort of like well down it as of 9/11 in terms of the change in the way that we collect data. But let's talk about how drones aren't when we talk about drones, we're not simply talking about drones in and of themselves, but what they represent in terms of warfare and data collection.
When we most people think about drones, Sam, they think about the killing machines, the large airplane-sized predator drones that are responsible for the targeted assassination campaign in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and elsewhere, but in reality, the vast majority of drones are merely intelligence collectors, and those numbers have ballooned from about 200 or so drones of all types in the U.S. military on 9/11 to over 14,000 today. So think of them as the proliferation of smartphones, if you will, in the last decade and a half. And then think of them in terms of how much data they're producing, because every day we probably have 50 or so long-range intercontinental drones collecting data all around the world, and we have hundreds of other drones which are now an organic part of our military forces and our spying efforts, even of our law enforcement efforts, that are collecting their own data. In fact, the military likes to say that it collects 8 seasons worth of NFL games every day.
Wow.
That's how much video it collects. And so really what the revolution has been how to process and utilize this vast amount of data that's being collected. And of course, mostly it is data. I mean, we imagine that somehow we're engaged in a process of trying to understand the world better through our intelligence collection and analysis efforts. But what I discovered in really getting into the world of drones is that it was mostly a targeting effort. We are basically involved in an effort to find people, to network people, and to find them precisely enough to kill them on an individual level. And so really our intelligence effort just transformed in the last decade and a half from what we used to think of, which was a bunch of regional and country specialists and technical specialists learning more and more about the enemy, to a very tactically oriented targeted killing effort.
So, I mean, so what are the implications of that? I mean, you know, and tease out what the implications were before this era. I mean, in other words, like when we were gathering intelligence prior to this shift, what were we doing and what kind of, I guess, disposition or posture were we in versus where we are now? I mean, I understand what you're talking about in terms of like we've gone from sort of like broadly understanding things to simply identifying things in some way. But what does that mean in terms of a bigger posture towards our attitude towards both in terms of what our theoretically our enemies are, both domestic and international, and sort of crime fighting?
Well, I think there's two major implications for how we look at the world and how it has transformed. You know, first, the book is called Unmanned. And so really a key part of understanding the evolution of U.S. national security since the 1990s, and that's really when it began, is the unmanning of this system. That began with cruise missiles, which used to be the way in which the United States expressed its displeasure, whether that was in the former Yugoslavia or Iraq or elsewhere. And we would shoot these unmanned cruise missiles off, and the Bush administration, of course, came to office saying, that's a feckless strategy of swatting at flies, and that's why we were so ineffective against Osama bin Laden. But drones have essentially taken over that same unmanned role. And so if you look at the U.S. military and the intelligence world today, it used to be the case in the time of, say, Vietnam, where there was one intelligence specialist supporting about every 100 soldiers in the field. And today, it's exactly the opposite. There are about 100 intelligence specialists all over the world in a global network of collection, processing, and analysis supporting every one soldier out there in the field. And so the number of people who actually are engaged in battle versus the number of people who are engaged in this sort of global hunt has completely reversed itself in the last 40 years. And in the last 15 years, just since 9/11, this unmanning of the American military and national security state has also changed how the rest of the world, how our adversaries see us, because you could make an argument, I would make an argument today, that 9/11 was not a random event. It was a reaction to a wide variety of things that occurred in the world. And those who wanted to bring down the World Trade Center and attack the Pentagon did so because they felt that this growing world of American immunity that was facilitated by its superior technology, that America needed to be attacked in its heart, that was the only way that our enemies could get back at us. And now we've just really magnified that in spades. Most people probably don't even understand that the vast majority of targeting that's going on right now today in Syria is taking place in Georgia, in Florida, in California, in Nevada, that because of modern communications, the actual warfare is being directed and conducted from these remote places. And so the number of people that we need to put forward in order to actually, quote, fight a war is tiny compared to what it used to be. Well, that changes then the nature of how people see the United States and what kind of vulnerabilities the United States creates for itself. So this style of warfare might be more efficient and it might be less deadly, but it also at the same time reshapes the world in a way that may increase, in fact, the vulnerabilities of the United States.
And it seems to me there's two distinct implications. That one is, you say that it and both of them emanate from the fact that in some ways we have less, I guess, I don't know, skin in the game, as it were. I mean, I hate to use that term, but that we are able, as a society, to wage war without feeling the effects of it in any way. And it also creates a sense that our only vulnerability when we wage war against other people is basically the civilian population. I mean, is that basically, do I have that?
Yes, of course. Of course, that's the nature of fighting a war against terrorism, which is that terrorists themselves hide amongst the civilian population. And so they also then therefore don't recognize the distinction between military and civilian. And so if we do things in our fight against terrorism that also at the same time ignores the distinction between military and civilian, if we do things that ignores the rule of law, And let me just give you an example today, because it's a really simple one. In 1986, the United States, under the Reagan administration, decided that it was going to bomb Libya in retaliation for a terrorist attack against U.S. soldiers in Berlin. And it was called the LaBelle Disco bombing. And the airplanes that flew that bombing mission when they took off from England had to fly around France and around Spain in order to get into the Mediterranean and bomb Libya, because the governments of France and Spain denied them clearance to fly through their airspace. Okay? Now, today, in 2015, our civilization has somehow reversed itself. And you've got Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen. You've got Egyptians bombing Libya. You've got Americans bombing nine countries right now. You've got drones overflying other countries without any permission. You've got the United States conducting a 15-year-long war, covert war in Pakistan that it doesn't even acknowledge. So the whole structure of world sovereignty has sort of been transformed by this style of warfare. And if we're essentially communicating to the rest of the world that borders are meaningless, then we're also communicating to those who wish us harm that that we don't have any inherent protections in our own borders, that we don't have any distinction with our own civilian population. So we are actually creating the conditions in the world in which the respect for the rule of law and the respect for sovereignty is diminishing as a norm. And as a result of that, of course, anyone can bomb anyone, and they don't even get condemned by the United Nations. No one even remarks when Saudi Arabia decides to take an airplane off and bomb a sovereign nation next door to it, or when Turkey decides to bomb the Kurds in Iraq. Nobody even blinks an eye anymore. That is really a reversal of the rule of law and civilization.
And I guess it's just, I mean, there was a story the other day I saw in the that Pakistan has carried out its first ever, I guess, locally developed drone strike on its own country. I mean, it really is just a matter of time in some ways before this becomes this sort of low level buzzing almost.
Well, I think to some degree, to tell you the truth, it's already started. You know, you have the Department of Homeland Security flying drones over America along the borders. You have the Coast Guard flying drones as part of its maritime surveillance efforts. You have low-orbit satellites, which are only 100 miles up there, which are being launched and flown continuously in America and around the world, not just by us, but by other countries as well who have their own satellites and their own drones. And it just seems to me like we're building an anarchic system. And of course, the whole point of international security is to have a set of norms that everyone agrees to and follows. And I'm not saying that I'm not like saying that warfare can be eliminated or that there isn't going to be a terrific fight between the West and Islam in the future. But I'm saying, why are we necessarily choosing the strategies of warfare that are exacerbating the basic stimuli and problems that are associated with why others want to do direct harm to us?
I get the sense from what you've written that it's not necessarily a choice per se, that it's not as if one person has said, this is what we're going to do, but rather it's almost there's almost like a current, or sort of it's the natural progression of a bureaucracy or a system that is built on just data collection in some way.
Well, I mean, I guess this is sort of a cockeyed way of being a little bit optimistic. I mean, I think you're right. No one did design the system. It's sort of just accreted, like global warming. Our national security state has evolved since the 1990s in this way. And then because of constant warfare, it, of course, innovated and technologically advanced generations over generations because there was a need to have greater technology. So I think to me, it's sort of like, well, then we can decide what do we want. Because it's not like somebody has thoughtfully said this is the strategy that is the best strategy for America. I think that the inability of the Obama administration to have much influence over national security and its inability to accrue much advantage from the withdrawal of U.S. combat troops from Afghanistan and Iraq sort of shows how static and how constipated the system is. And so to me, I guess the optimism that I leave with is, well, I guess that means that we could have some influence over what the future design of our national security is, because what's happened since 9/11 has been just a frenzied growth of a permanent system that operates essentially without much public input or intervention.
I mean, talk a little bit about that dichotomy that you talk about, where the Obama administration and the national security, I don't know, some people refer to it as the deep state, that those things are such distinct entities. I mean, because I don't know that people sort of contemplate it in that way.
Well, you know, in 1974, when I joined the Army, so I served in the Army from 1974 to 78, it was the beginning of the volunteer force and the end of the Vietnam and the draft era. And the notion of there being a professional military, the notion of there being a professional national security state, I don't think anybody really anticipated what the implications of that would be 40 years later. But here we are 40 years later, and the fact of the matter is that we have a permanent national security bureaucracy. And we have it, and it is increasingly concentrated in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, which also happens to be the richest area in America, the area with the least amount of unemployment. I think seven of the top 15 wealthiest counties in America are in the D.C. metropolitan area. So we can see a socioeconomic shift that has actually occurred as a result of 9/11, and it has concentrated national security in some professional ranks. But it's not, you know, it's not just a job to be done. It's not the production of national security on an assembly line. It actually takes thought to imagine what's the best strategies and what's the best tack and what's the best approach for America. And yet we've sort of given up our civic responsibility and our civic involvement in national security by virtue of the fact that financially and personally, it doesn't touch the lives of most people.
And it also seems to me that there's a parallel in just that the way that we approach intelligence, if you will, and national security in that regard, because we've sort of changed from intelligence, which is to learn about things and as a way of sort of preparing ourselves, I guess, and working out contingencies, to just collecting data and having algorithms that sort of filter that data without really any thought beyond the algorithm. That's just sort of like pop up potential targets that we then go out and seek.
Well, I mean, I think that war against ISIS in Syria is the perfect example of what you describe. When President Obama announced a year ago that the United States was going to undertake military action against ISIS, he said, A, we need to collect the intelligence that we need in order to do the job, and B, that we're not going to put boots on the ground. So intrinsically, he was even assuring the American people, well, we're going to go ahead and go forth and do this in exactly the way we've tried to do it in Pakistan, or we've tried to do it in other places, without any real consideration of whether or not this was the right strategy or made any sense. And it seems to me in the year that we've been bombing ISIS, all we've watched is an expansion of its capabilities and power. And frankly, if you look at the world today compared to 9/11, I can't name one country in the Middle East that is more stable today than it was 15 years ago. So I cannot imagine how anyone in their right mind could say that we're following the right international approach.
And but let's also shift to domestic, because, you know, you had a piece, I think it was about a year ago, about that I remember specifically listing that there were it seems like sort of an exponential number of agencies ranging from like the Supreme Court, I remember, having undercover agents. I mean, there were just a wide array of agencies, and forgive me, I can't remember which ones, but I just remember the story being like, wait, what? And this idea that, I'm curious as to how you see this stuff, and maybe you've talked about it in terms of sort of like that delineation between our enemies and the civilian population sort of becoming blurred, at least internationally. It seems to also has happened domestically, too.
Well, the first thing that's happened domestically is we created something called the Department of Homeland Security in our panic after 9/11. And I don't know anyone in their right mind who thinks that the Department of Homeland Security is a good idea or necessarily even an essential agency of the government. But yet when you put $50 billion into an institution, and that money starts to proliferate out to police departments and state governments and fusion centers and efforts of counter trafficking and counter this and counter that, then you are creating sort of the same aesthetic of national security at home that you are overseas. And of course, because 9/11 was an attack on the United States, and because there have been other attacks and other attempts on the United States, the national security state itself doesn't necessarily draw the distinctions between what happened overseas and what happened in the United States. It's not so much that the Supreme Court police has an undercover unit, though that should worry people. It's more that the CIA is not authorized to do work domestically, and yet what we've done instead is transformed the FBI to be just like the CIA. And right. So the military is not allowed to do certain covert operations, so we have the CIA do them. And then when the CIA doesn't want to do them, we've created a CIA inside the military in the form of special operations that does what the CIA does. So in essence, what we have done is eroded all of these legal and important symbolic distinctions between organizations, and as a result, everyone wants a piece of national security. Well, it also means that they want national security, and the national security prospers when there's war. And so I can't help but think at the same time that there's no one in this world who necessarily wants to say on a day-to-day basis, thank you very much, Senator, for the $1 billion that you want to give me, but we don't really need it because the threat just isn't there. Right. I mean, there's no adjudicative body that says, sorry, you can't have that money. So we just keep throwing more and more money at national security, and part of that is then the buildup of institutions internationally and domestically that are fighting this war, which the government openly says, without anyone protesting, is perpetual and going to go on forever.
I mean, and part of the, I mean, when you get that money to work on national security, part of your job is, even if it's not explicit, even if it's not, something that you're conscious of, you are a solution looking for a problem. And so there's a certain amount of incentive to create or to find problems or to expand the definition of what is a problem.
Well, I mean, we have had a bad habit in America of using the expression war on for a long time. War on drugs, war on fat, war on whatever it might be. And now when we're fighting in a real war, those junior varsity wars, of course, want to attach themselves to the money and the prestige of the real war. So our counter narcotics process now is counter narco-terrorism and counter trafficking, which sounds all wonderful in terms of human rights, is about tracking people as they move across borders, and aviation security becomes a process of trying to collect the biometrics of everyone in the world. And so it's not just that I'm not saying we shouldn't have security programs. I'm not saying we shouldn't even have some kind of a battle against terrorism. I just think that we have to impose some limits. And unfortunately, in the 16 years of Bush and Obama, it seems to me that very few limits have been imposed.
Where can those? I mean, how can that happen? I mean, is it if I don't want to get too bleak here, but if we have, if these things are sort of largely out of sight, right? And people aren't, you know, unless you're either sort of like actively looking for this stuff, your average person's not going to be aware to the extent that their lives are being touched by this. And to the extent that they are, maybe they don't care. And we see a president who, at least as a candidate, seemed to be fairly good on this stuff. And we see what happens when he gets into office. Where does it end? Or am I... Is that the next book?
Well, I don't know where it ends, but I think that part of what it really is demanded, and I don't want to be too ephemeral about it, is civic involvement on the part of the American population. I mean, just because you don't have a son or daughter or nephew or niece in the U.S. military, just because you don't work for the CIA or you don't work for Lockheed Martin or Booz Allen or SAIC, doesn't mean that you don't have skin in the game, as you said. You do. And so when we're buffeted every day by the same procedures at airports and by reports of cybersecurity vulnerabilities and other vulnerabilities, which increasingly basically improves the control of government. I mean, I hate to say it, but the nature of government is to be as voracious as possible. And our founding fathers did everything that they could to try to constrain the power of government. And now we seem to have surrendered all of the decision making and all of the power to our government. And it's not our government. It's a government that's waging a war for itself without much direct involvement of the majority of the American people.
William Arkin, the book is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect War. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Bye-bye. So that was a little bleak. I mean, it's the fascinating questions that, it seems very easy for us to avoid asking. And, you know, as he writes in his book, that much of what we see in terms of what we get drones to do today in terms of as opposed to their function as just basically being data vacuums. that hoover up all of this data and just sort of wait until something hits an algorithm, lights up. But in terms of like predator drones, in terms of these missile attacks, we had already established this in the 90s, and it 9/11 happens in 1985. I would imagine our response is much different than it would have been in the year 2000, just in terms of where technology was. We now have the capacity, and in 10 years, the idea of a drone flying into your home or going through an apartment building and walking in and just sort of surveying what's going on seems like it's around the corner. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Folks, a reminder, it is your support for this program that makes it possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm or join the Majority Report. Also, a note, programming note. Tomorrow, the program will begin at 11 a.m. Eastern. 11 a.m. Eastern. Special Friday, early 11 a.m. start. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Number 646-257-3920 is the number, 646-257-3920. You can IM me through the app. You can pick up the app at majorityapp.com. Give us a review on iTunes or just a rating at majority.fm/review. Majority.fm/review. It helps. Gets us up in the rankings. And then more people listen to the program. Then we feel better about ourselves. We'll be right back.